Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 285 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Marcy Kahan speaks with Gabriel Badamosi about rejecting the overly literary via her inner clown, writing urbane romantic comedies for radio, why fascists hate satire, and her long-running series, Lunch.
Marcy Kahan is a playwright, writer also of screenplays, poetry, musicals and libretti. She has specialised in radio drama. Nothing quite prepares you for the way she grabs your attention from the washing up for 90 minutes with Stanislavski, or how she thrills you with her series of murder mysteries featuring the dry wit and acid commentary on human affairs of her unexpected detective, Noel Coward. There's life in the old boy yet. Brought up in Montreal, Marcy Kahan studied English at Oxford and trained at the Lecoq School for Clowns in Paris. Drawing on a wide range of theatre traditions, from the Marx Brothers to the Moscow Arts Theatre, Noel Coward to Molière, her work demonstrates the continuing pleasures of an incisive, satirical intelligence. Marcy, tell us something about yourself. You're a writer of plays for the theatre, for radio. You've specialised in radio drama, of poems, of libretti. How would you describe yourself as a writer?
I would describe myself as a playwright, as a dramatist. And I'm interested in all those forms. I've written two musicals that haven't got past workshop stage. And actually, the musical is one of my favorite forms. Not the current musical, but the musical, the great classic Broadway musical that goes from Showboat in 1927 to Stephen Sondheim.
Shall we leap in to your experience as a playwright? You came from Canada, you're Canadian-American.
Yes.
To study English at Somerville College in Oxford.
Yeah.
You'd read all the classics, Aristotle, Shakespeare, Chekhov. But then you took yourself off from London to Paris to study at the Lecoq School with Philippe Gaulier, Monica Pagneux.
Pagneux, yes.
As far as I understand, the Lecoq School is a training to enable you to find your inner clown. How has that impacted on you as a playwright?
Well, I began writing plays when I was 7 years old. And so my inner clown was very, very much alive at that time. And my plays were extremely animated and imaginative. And I was given a first-class education. And the more educated I became academically, the deader, the more literary the plays became. And even though I'd been to a drama school when I was 16... And all of my friends from then on, all of my good friends have always been actors. And I was fascinated by acting. I realized when I left Oxford that I needed some kind of practical, imaginative understanding in what actors do. And one of my great friends at that time, when I came down to London, was the actor Alan Rickman, who was a mentor to scores of young actors and young writers. And Alan had heard that these two extraordinary Lecoq teachers had formed their own studio in Paris, and you didn't have to audition. You just had to turn up with the right number of francs, the right amount of French francs, and you could enroll. And that's what I did. And those 2 years with those great teachers made me the playwright that I am. I think the main thing was bypassing language and meaning and just learning how to establish a scene on the basis of rhythm was wonderful for me.
I noticed that your first radio play was actually with Alan Rickman.
Yes,
a play called The Contemplative Life, in which he plays a homicidal Benedictine monk.
Yes, The Contemplative Life has impeccable literary source, Robert Browning's Soliloquy of the Spanish Cloister, perhaps the only poem in the English language that begins with the word grr. And I'd read it in high school, and in high school I looked at it and thought, that would make a wonderful radio play, and then I got a bit older and I wrote it. My residence at that time, my official London residence, was Alan Rickman's sofa, and he was going off to Broadcasting House one morning to record a play, and this inspired me to finish this play about a Benedictine monk. And he got home that evening, and I said, I finished my radio play, and I gave it to him. And I remember he said, well, it can't be any worse than the one we were just recording. The actors were busy rewriting it in the BBC cafeteria. And he read it, and he said, I think it's good. And he gave it to the director. And then the director said, it's far too offbeat for Radio 4. And she gave it to a director I worked with a lot in my career, Ned Shaya, the American Ned Shaya, who was the play editor for Radio 3. And I still have the letter from Ned Shaya saying, you have a natural ear for radio. We hope this is the beginning of many more. They then said to me, who would you like to play the homicidal Benedictine monk? And I said Orson Welles, because Orson Welles was a great childhood hero.
So Alan Rickman had to find his inner Orson Welles.
And they were terrified of trying to contact Orson, who was still alive. He died the following year, but he was still alive in 1984 when we were having this conversation. And then they said, Marcy, aren't you a great friend of Alan Rickman? Shouldn't he be playing the homicidal Benedictine monk? And I said, but that would be nepotism. And he did play it, and he was wonderful. And the recording, it's of course, it's one of my great treasured possessions now.
Let me go to the particular kind of comedy that you write. You sometimes refer to it as satire, and that what you admire most in both writing and acting is an incisive satirical intelligence.
Yes, I rate that very highly.
Somewhere else I came across a reference you made to maintaining an ambivalence between the romantic and the cynical.
I don't think when I sit down to write the play I'm thinking in terms of those categories. The comments that I've made about the type of plays that I write, they're kind of after the fact, and they're removed from the process of writing the play. So when I'm writing the play, I'm not thinking I need an ambivalence here between romance, satire, and other things. I'm just writing it. So I think what I'm probably analyzing is my own instinctive approach and attitude of mind toward the world. Now, this may derive from the fact that I have an ambivalence about nationality. I have an ambivalence about religion. I have an ambivalence about gender. So the fact that I'm hard to categorize, am I Canadian? Am I American? Am I British? Am I a boyish girl? Or am I even beyond that? Am I androgynous? The way that I dealt with that is writing plays that kind of explode
these categories.
I think so. Actually, listening to you has made me realize that I became a playwright at the age of 7 and continued because it was a way of freeing myself and continuing to be free, not to get ground down in any kind of boring and restrictive tribalism. And I think the writers I admire and the writers I respond to ultimately have that sense of freedom. When I talk about my hero, Noel Coward, my favorite line about him is from the playwright Simon Gray, who was asked one day, what do you think of Noel Coward? And he said, I always have felt that Noel Coward was on the side of life. And I think that's what I want to put in my plays. I want to put in more life. And that means transcending barriers. Now, when I go to a party in London, I don't think there is a single party I've ever been to where if I'm talking to someone I've just met, they instantly want to know, are you American? Oh, maybe you're Canadian. How long have you been here? You know, there's the kind of immigration interview thing that happens. And then, oh, you're a playwright. What kind of plays do you write? All of the categories are looming really, really large in the air. So as a kind of shortcut, I say, well, I've been here most of my life. And basically, I'm a Londoner. And what kind of plays do I write? I write urbane and occasionally intensely romantic comedies. So that's kind of a way of I guess, of saying, I find the categorization conversation deeply boring.
There are two versions that people kind of hold in their head of satire. And maybe they say it's Horace, maybe they say it's Juvenal. But to characterize them, there's satire as kind of as wit, this dish full of varied fruits. And then there's probably a sort of an asp lurking amongst them somewhere, versus the form of satire that most people think of, which is the whip, you know, the correction of kind of vice.
Yeah.
It seems to me that ostensibly, yours is the dish full of fruits. It is delicious to listen to one of your very wicked sort of social comedies. On the other hand, I feel that there is something that you're critiquing. Do you want to change our sensibility?
I think my first objective with the plays is to entertain. Second objective, at moments, to move the audience. And it isn't necessarily a big 1, 2, 3. So to entertain, to move my audience and those who are disposed to think, to make them think and possibly rethink again. But I think a good comedy, and the reason fascists don't tend to go to many comedies,
don't laugh,
and they don't laugh, and they don't rate comedy, and they don't rate satire, is that by definition, if you're exposing yourself to a level of ridicule and a spirit of comic inclusiveness and of surprise and of reversals and truth-telling through laughter, that's going to change you. I think I've always believed that about comedy.
You have?
That it's dangerous in that if you are narrow-minded and doctrinaire, don't go near it, because the physical act of laughing, of exploding with laughter, or of being amused in your head and being able to see 360 degrees round a situation, it's not good for the narrow-minded.
There you are, Marcy Kahan, specialised in radio drama, writing these kind of wickedly funny comedies. But I noticed that you have taken up an African journal on your trips to Africa. I particularly picked that up. Where is your African journal taking you?
My African journal was, I was noting the landscape, the people, the tourists looking at the landscape and the animals and the people. And we were traveling with an astronomer. So we were also looking at the heavens. So that was very much taking me out of my usual urban territory. It was very that African trip was very, very good for me.
So you are on a further journey now?
Very much so.
And it might have less to do with the urbane, the urban, and more to do with the natural world, perhaps attached to issues around climate change, around race, culture, history.
It resulted in a short play called A Very Long Night on the Serengeti, based on a personal experience during that journal. I was reading in my tent. I had a tent to myself on the Serengeti during this safari, and I switched off the light, and the moon was high in the heavens that night, and I became aware that there was a lion parked directly outside the mesh netting of my tent. And I had a night with me and the lion, and every time I shifted in bed, the lion just outside shifted. And my way of coping with this deeply uncomfortable experience when I got back to London is I wrote a dialogue between myself and the beast.
You now have a totemic animal.
I do. And that night, you know, how long was the lion going to stay on that side of the netting? So that was, I guess, I mean, the lion was an encounter with death.
Yes.
With the end of life. Yeah.
Can I turn to your work with actors and as an actor? You have a performance life.
Yes.
Yes. Tell us about that.
Yes. My performance life is private in that when I'm writing the plays, as you know, as a playwright, it's a very good idea to speak them aloud and to make sure that they come off the page. I teach, and when I'm teaching, that if it's done with energy and vivacity, that's a kind of performance. Once a year, if I'm lucky, the Chelsea Arts Club allows me to write and perform a continuity script for our annual salute to the Great American Songbook. So that's kind of as far as the performance goes.
I must smuggle myself into one of your classes.
I've been asked why I don't do stand-up. And in the romantic comedy series that I've just finished for Radio 4 called Lunch, I have two characters, Bill and Bella. And at one point, Bill has an affair and is very, very much taken with a stand-up comedy performer. And I did a lot of work in terms of, you know, the background, even though she's an offstage character, in terms of how you set up a gig, how you write a gig, what happens on the performance circuit. And stand-up comedy for me would be too direct and too brutal. I would much prefer to have Stephen Mangan and Claire Skinner come into a BBC studio and perform my comedy.
You work with very particular kind of actors. Malcolm Sinclair, for example, who does an enormously wonderful Noel Coward with Eleanor Bron as his secretary.
Some of my favourite actors, yes.
Yes, but the two actors that you worked with in Lunch, can we look at that? Lunch was a short episode comedy drama, 15 minutes an episode, but it ran through 5 series.
Yes.
And it's two people who kind of meet, never had quite got together, though they once kind of shared a flat, who meet and sort of fence, meet, don't meet. Can you talk us through such an enormous amount of writing for two particular actors? They're the only people that we hear. They're the only people who talk. What's that like?
Lunch began with Radio 4 letting a group of experienced writers know that they were looking for long runners on Radio 4. They wanted to find ideas and situations that would run for a while. And at about that time, I was just reminded that throughout my life, I found myself having lunch with men I might have married. And those lunches, there's a frisson to those lunches. There's an added tension and an added pleasure and an added excitement. And that's so the idea came from having been in that situation. And then I invented Bill and Bella. And I think from the beginning, I thought, I'll make him a right-wing economist and I'll make her left-wing and more bohemian, trying to juggle a portfolio of jobs. So she's a yoga teacher. She conducts a Proust seminar in an old people's home, a very erudite old people's home up in Highgate. At one point, she gets a job watering plants in a kind of corporate headquarters. So they've taken very different routes, but they were old friends in graduate school, and they meet for lunch once a month. And my premise was they talk about absolutely everything. They disagree. They support each other. But the one thing they can't talk about is how much they love each other.
And that sustains it across 5
Well, when I series. Wrote it, when I wrote it, I thought this will go on for 20 years because they talk about everything. And at the very first recording, after I'd done 5 episodes, all anybody in the studio wanted to know was, are they going to get together in the next series? And I realized I had the lunch, my dinner with Andre scenario, but I also had the When Harry Met Sally romantic comedy framework. And that eventually they'd have to get together. So every September, I had to sit down and they had to come together again. And I had to get them to episode 5, not getting together. And I decided, Radio 4 loved it and they wanted me to go on writing it forever. And I said, I would rather bring it to a climax and, you know, keep the audience wondering right to the last second whether they're going to get together. And the last episode is called Room Service and takes place in a hotel. But the episode is, they're in a hotel room. They've never been in a hotel room. Are they going to get to the next stage, or are they going to agree to going back to just having lunch? So I kept it going right till the end. And I think I made the right decision.
You end on a cliffhanger.
I ended it. I'm not going to tell you what it is because I don't think you've heard it yet. But I did make the decision and I did end it. but I preferred to go out when it was still very, very strong. Then, you know, those series that go on for 19 years, which when you tune into them, you switch off again because the writers are getting tired.
At some point, less is more. Gotcha. Just to wrap up now, you never like to speak about kind of future projects.
No.
Because no, that jinxes them.
It jinxes them. I tell my playwriting students, you have to keep the excitement of the idea your secret, because if it gets out there, the energy is dissipated, and the next time you sit down to work on it, you had the experience of releasing the idea, and it's diminished it.
So I don't want to ask you about future projects, but I do somehow want to ask you about kind of where you're moving to. You have such a range, such a back catalogue, such a range of work, bringing in so many different kind of qualities of kind of human, emotional, psychological experience. I mean, who are these characters? What do they feel? What is possible? Do you feel that your work might, without referring it to a particular kind of project, do you think your work might move, as it were, in the direction of some of your other heroes, such as Tennessee Williams, into more serious, more tragic, darker areas of experience?
I can't ever imagine becoming that kind of serious literary novelist. But I'm now very tempted to go back to the screenplay form. And my first screenplay was produced by the BBC, and Miramax in New York distributed it.
It won prizes.
It went around the world. It, in fact, it bought me my flat in Fitzrovia. It was the most marvelous thing to happen to me in my early 30s. And I didn't have success with other screenplays that I wrote. I didn't get them off the ground. As you know, it's a very difficult form, dependent on many things. But I would like to go back to the screenplay. And I've never written a novel. And again, that's something that I think I should do. I mean, perhaps I'll have to write 5 novels before there's one that I think anybody will want to look at.
Mercy Khan, thank you.
Thank you, Gabriel. It's been a pleasure.
That was Marcy Kahan in conversation with Gabriel Bettamosi. You can find out more about Marcy on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 285, which was recorded by Gabriel Bettamosi and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 286, Alison Hallett speaks with Jane Draycott about artistic stones, anonymous creativity, and the legacy of a secret affair. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.